Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Worst First. This is my first Zoom ever. My first Zoom, not ever, but podcast. I don't typically do that. And I'm here today with my guest, Bob Saget. I'm so excited to have you here.
As
I did
am
clapping.
I.
You can't hear it. I did. There's clapping going on.
I love it.
Thank you for being here and thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I mean, I wrote a book about it. You know,
What was your book called?
It was called Dirty Daddy. It was a
Dirty Daddy.
It was, yeah, and it was actually a New York Times bestseller. He said self-promotionally, but it really dealt with a comedy and death and how they intersect throughout my life.
Oh my God, that's the truth. And
it's heavy
do you
stuff.
Have any kids?
I have three daughters that
you have
are
three daughters
that I know of that are 33, 31, and 28.
Well, that's why we brought you here today, Bob, because I'm one of your fourth daughters.
Please say hi to your mom and tell
her. Can you imagine if all of a sudden it was just like a Mari episode and I was like, hi, it's me, Katrina, your secret daughter. Bring her out. Worst first. Bob Saget finds out he has another daughter.
I'm your Katrina, your life hurricane.
Right.
It's always good to do a hurricane reference when you start. It always
love that.
Makes people so happy because the world right now, a hurricane is mild compared to the rest of the world issues. Not really. It's not, you know.
Well, things are very hard right now. You're only doing Zoom podcasts. That's what they told me. You're not meeting anyone in person. So you're taking everything very seriously, which is great.
I did a couple of those game shows. I did like To Tell the Truth with Anthony Anderson. I was on Masked Singer, but to do that, it was crazy amount of protocol. You know, they had everybody safe, you know, so.
Yeah, they are very careful with that. So we're going to dive right in. I really love to get to bring people on here to talk about some of the worst things that have ever happened to them in their life. And I know I get some people on here that say, you know, I had a great life and not really anything that bad has happened. And I hate those people. So
well, they're in denial. Like, I mean,
they're in denial. I'm like, come on, nothing, not even getting bullied, nothing.
Right. What about your breech birth?
Right. What about the umbilical cord around your neck? You know,
right.
What about when you wore those ugly pants in high school? And that was horrible. So you said you wrote your book, you highlighted a lot of the hard things that went on in your life.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what you want to start with. I'm going to kind of let you go.
Well, there, you know, everybody right now, especially has more horror than they've had pretty much ever for a lot of people. And isn't it weird that even though they're older and then they're 90s, but people are every day, three people are gone. Well-known people that we loved and some people that were like, well, okay. But, but other people, it's just so tragic because for the older people, it's pretty finite right now, you know, because of the COVID. I don't know if you heard about COVID, but it's a thing that's out.
It's scary. I mean, I've been really careful. I even have like glass set up in here. And have you lost anyone close to you?
I know people, but. Okay. They weren't directly close. I've had a couple friends with it, several friends with it.
Oh my gosh.
One when it first came out in New York and he was almost on a ventilator. And then at the last minute, they were able to just use forced oxygen, but he's okay now. And he's a beautiful person and he's young. Ooh. I mean, he's, you know, 50. I mean, that's, you know, we don't want to be losing people.
I think
a lot could be prevented, but we want to talk about things that are the worst things I've had. And
yeah. So where did you grow up? Like, I don't even know. I want to talk about your worst. I want to talk about where did you grow up?
I was born in Philadelphia, but then I moved.
I grew up outside Philadelphia.
Where?
I grew up in Upper Bucks County.
My sister was a teacher there, Gay Saget.
Really?
I know it's a rough name. She, you know, she had a rough name, man.
I wasn't going to say it. I was going to say, hey, is she available for worst first next week?
No, it's crazy. And then it's weird when you're talking, you know, I always go, it was rough, man, but you're not a man. So it's just a vernacular. I'm not even allowed to go, hi guys, to a group of all men and women.
I feel like you can. I mean, I'm
coming from a good place with it, you know, I mean, anyway.
So you grew up out in Philadelphia.
I'm trying to cancel myself. Yeah, I grew up in Philly. She was a teacher in Bucks County, a really good teacher. And I went to Temple University.
You went to Temple. Oh, wow.
And I graduated Abington, but I was born in Philly. Then I moved. This is my worst first. Never stopped moving. So I went from Philly, and at about 5 or 6, I moved to Norfolk, Virginia. And then I lived there till the middle of 9th grade. And my dad got transferred by Food Fair, Pantry Pride, Supermarkets, because he was a meat executive, another worst first, and then went from there to Encino, California. Didn't know anybody the second half of 9th grade. Couldn't take Algebra 2 because I wasn't taking it in Norfolk, Virginia. So I made no friends at Encino. I made a couple friends, but and then between 11th and 12th grade, moved back to Philadelphia to Abington High School. So I didn't have any consistency, and then lived at home for college and was a deli clerk. This is all worse first. And then went to Temple University Film School, and then things started to look up. And then I moved to LA in 78 when you were not even born.
Not born yet.
Not born.
But wait, so how did you decide that you were going to get into comedy?
It was all organic, and I was going to go pre-med. I even was planning to do that. But I started writing songs, really bad ones, when I was like 14, 15. Uh-huh. And I would register them with the Library of Congress, you know, copyright them. And it was
no one's stealing this song about potatoes.
Oh,
hell
it was
no.
So bad. It was like I was a boy. I wrote a song about going to war because I had a cousin that had been in the Vietnam War. It was not good. And then I started making movies, 8mm crap, when I was like 9, and made like 60 hours of movies. And then when I was in college, I did stand up. I won a radio contest with WMMR.
Okay.
Remember WMMR? Yeah, I know WMMR. So they were kind of the hardest rock, I guess, that was there. YSP was the other one. Tommy Lee would know. You know him.
And, I kind of know him, yeah. Hilarious.
And then I won this radio contest for a song about bondage when I was 17 years old. I was writing comedy songs and everything was weird. And here I was looking like somebody's, you know, a dentist's child, you know, an accountant. And I was writing demented stuff. My comedy was always weird. And then I did improv at the University of Pennsylvania with my friends in a group called Mixed Nuts. So that was when SNL
Mixed
first
Nuts.
Started.
Wow.
So then I also made movies at Temple, and I won the student Oscar for a movie I made about my nephew getting his face reconstructed. So those were good things.
Those are all really great things.
But you asked me a question, I give you a 40-minute answer. I'm sorry.
No, I love it. I actually love hearing your story because, I mean, obviously I grew up watching you on TV and, you know, all over.
Was I a dad to you?
You know, you weren't, but I had a really great dad, so I didn't have you as a dad, but I did watch Funniest Home Videos. Like, that was my jam. Like, that was, like, all we watched. That was the funny. I mean, when you were on there, it was, like, the peak of Funniest Home Videos.
Oh, thank you. I started it off. I was the beginning of the Nut Hit.
That was my favorite show. I mean, my family and I, we would always watch that. That was, like, How to Get Your Laugh, you know what I mean?
There was no YouTube. There was no internet.
No, so you couldn't go watch cat videos online. You had to wait for Funniest Home Videos.
Yeah, I was the gatekeeper of cats and Nut Hits. And
yes. Oh, my God, that's so funny. Okay, so you move to L.A., back to L.A. You start, you know, doing the grind. You're doing stand-up.
I'm hosting at the Comedy Store a lot for like 6-7 years. Yeah.
Okay, and so what's your first big break?
I had a bunch of them. The first one was, I guess, Rodney Dangerfield's Young Comedian special. Uh-huh. I guess I was 24, 25, and I became friends with Rodney, and I introduced him to Sam Kennison. That's all.
Oh, wow.
That's how old I am. And and then that was on HBO, so that did well, but nothing really ever moved the needle until I started shooting up. No, that's not worse first. I didn't ever shot
up. Did you
up,
shoot
never
up?
Did.
Okay.
No,
I'm like,
no.
We can talk about
that'll
it.
That'll be
here.
The quote because you're quotable. Your podcast is so quotable because the premise alone.
No.
And then I guess I was in one of my best things that happened was I was in a Richard Pryor movie, Critical Condition, mm-hmm. Directed by Michael Apted, who we just lost, great director. And so I had been friends with Richard from the Comedy Store, but then got even closer after this movie. And then never thought I'd work again. I was my worst first, and I know you do a lot about mental health and talk about it a lot. Is all more personal than showbiz stuff. And
you keep you have like self-deprecation a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that
I have
kind of-
self-defecation as well because I hate my poo.
So, but you're hard on yourself. And is that something that you've always struggled with? Like, do you feel like when you do well that you don't deserve it or that, you know, it's like imposter syndrome and that kind of thing? Because a lot of people with depression
feel like
you don't.
My depression was I just thought I was at the Comedy Store and watching all my friends go get TV shows, Howie Mandel, Arsenio, all my friends, they were all leaving and I was still there hosting. Meanwhile, I was hosting, bringing out Eddie Murphy and Robin Williams and Richard. And, you know, I was at the best of the comedy people that are alive and not alive, unfortunately. And so, but, you know, everything you kind of look at and that's, you have to say it. I don't say it happened for a reason just because other people say that. It's so annoying. But I wouldn't trade what I had, although I wish I'd been able to cope better because I didn't even want to be alive in my 20s.
Why?
I knew I was good. So when I knew I wasn't there yet and I couldn't figure out how to be good, I wanted to be great because I was surrounded by greats. And then I would watch friends of mine excel to be just the best. And I was happy for them, never jealous ever.
But sad because you knew you could.
Sad because I wanted to do it. And so I went to acting school for years and I kept directing, never stopped directing stuff. And then, you know, work kind of fell upon me. It didn't, I didn't, the things I wanted the hardest, I usually didn't get. And the things that just came out of the air, that just happened, I did. And then the hardest stuff that happened is I lost a sister. She was 34. And so I was 28. So that's where my 20s were like, okay. And for about 4 years before she passed, she'd had a lot of mental health issues. And she'd also been culted by a cult a little bit.
Oh, got like brainwashed by some people?
More used than brainwashed. She was so fragile since she was young. She had epilepsy. She fell when she was like 15 and hit her head in a drugstore and had a seizure. And so that's the worst first was dealing, which I know a lot of people have dealt with someone that you love or care about or yourself going through something beyond your control.
Were you surprised by her death or was it sudden?
Well, her death was sudden because it was an aneurysm, we think, but at 34 and she was recovering and she was lovely. I mean, really lovely. I mean, I loved her probably about as much as you can love a person. And we were very close. And so that was a worst first was, and I'd had death my whole childhood because my father lost all of his brothers at 37 and 40 from heart attacks. So it was a lot of death. It's like, how do you make a comedian or how do you make a artist, you know?
Trauma. Just
throw a bunch of shit at him, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's like a way to cope.
And mental health is something that people, really, even with her, we tried to do group therapy and my parents they're not around anymore, but they realized the error of their ways that you do group therapy and you help your family therapy. You help the person in trouble. It's hard for people to own stuff, you know?
Would you say your parents were proactive in helping you guys when you were struggling with your mental health?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't on meds. I was actually just, you know, it was the early 80s. So I was at the Comedy Store with Sam Kennison.
Right.
And Robin. So, I mean, I was, you know, I was in my young 20s. I was just party boy and doing what I never got to do because I lived at home till I was, till I graduated college. I was super nerd. But yeah, they were very supportive of me always, always saying that I was going to do special stuff. Not meaning like, you know, weird.
You're going to be special, Bob. Yeah,
you're gonna
be
you're a fluffer in porn.
Real special. Like,
thank you, Mom.
Aww.
But I, they were very supportive of my sister's dilemma. My mom helped to get her in. She was an administrative assistant at University of Pennsylvania. So they helped get her in the psych ward there. But psych wards are not, you know,
they're not
they
cool.
Are.
Trust me. I've been in one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They're very scary. And,
I know many, many people, especially now.
Yeah.
What was your experience?
Well, I was.
Within reason. You don't have to.
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't mind. I've talked about it before when I, on other, my other podcasts. But yeah, I was 16 and I was really depressed. I lived with just my dad and my brother and I spent a lot of time alone. I didn't have a lot of friends and I just didn't want to be alive. But I also didn't want to kill myself because I felt bad for my dad because my dad always tried so hard to take care of us. And so I kind of felt bad. And so I started cutting because that was like a way to release endorphins without dying. And so I was cutting and I was hiding it. No one ever knew. And I was like the class clown. And then they were doing physicals at school because I went to public school and some kids couldn't afford to go to the doctor. So they would do mandatory physical for everybody. And right. I got called in to the nurse's office and I was like, oh, fuck. Because I knew they were going to like roll up my sleeves and my pants and they were going to see that I had cuts all over. And they did. And they ended up making a really big deal about it, calling an ambulance, taking me to the hospital, putting me in a room that was all rubber blue furniture. It was literally made of rubber so you couldn't like hurt yourself. And my dad was actually out of town at the time. And my aunt was watching us and they couldn't get a hold of her. And so then a social worker came in and was like, hey, we can't get a hold of anyone in your family. Like, I think you need to be put into a facility. And so then they took me over to this horrible place and it was outside the city and it was just dilapidated. It was not well managed. It was dirty. Everyone there, it smelled like piss. It was just like nasty.
Did it have people that were criminals and stuff in there? Did it have?
It had, well, because I was young, so I didn't go to like the adult one. I went to like one for juveniles. So I was in the section with everyone was around my age, around like 15, 16 years old. But these were like, some of them were inner city kids that were just fucked. I mean, like, I hate to say fucked up, but they'd been through some shit, you know what I mean? That would fuck anybody up. And so I wasn't on that level and they were just fucking gnarly. And I remember I was crying the first night and I've told this story on my podcast 1,000 times. I was crying the first night. And I like couldn't be quiet. And the nurse came in and she was like, if you don't shut up, I'm going to put you in the quiet room. And she dragged me by my hair down the hallway and takes me to this like big metal door. And it says the quiet room on the outside. And she opens it up. And then there's like a piss stained mattress on the floor. It's padded walls. And it was soundproof. It was a soundproof room. And that's where they put people who are being loud or disruptive to other patients. And it was fucking disgusting. And it was just horrible. It was the most dirty, disgusting. The nurses were mean. No one was compassionate. No one was loving, you know, because like I feel like a lot of people at that point, you know, they need someone who understands them. They need someone who is a friend who can listen.
They need connection.
Yeah, they need connection.
And they need who put you there?
The social worker.
Oh, so it wasn't done through a parent at all?
No, because my dad, they couldn't get a hold of my dad because he was on a business trip and my aunt was watching me at the time and they couldn't get a hold of her. So then they just threw me in there. And then that's when I got put on antidepressants and I've been stuck on this same antidepressant since I was 16 years old because they put me on one that's super hard to get off of. It's called Effexor XR. I don't know. You don't take anything? You don't have to share.
No,
it,
no.
So. Good
if I
you.
Had them, I would share them with you.
Yeah. No, I mean, not share with me, but no, share with everyone publicly.
No,
But I mean, yeah, I mean, I, and then that one's so, just so
did they
hard to get
try to titrate you off? That's what they mostly don't know. When you go into a psych ward, they give you just, they take you from zero to 500 milligrams.
They drug you 2000 milligrams
rather than what it should be, but they can't because it's covered by insurance. So it's, I don't know what the health system's going to be.
You've never taken any antidepressants?
No. No,
good for you. I mean, not that good for you, because it's okay if people take them. Obviously, like, they've changed my life in good ways and bad ways. But that's amazing. You've never tried an antidepressant. You've just kind of, what have you done when?
Done stuff to sleep, you know?
Right, of course.
Taking that. Ambien, I was on for like 10 years, and that was a destructive thing to be on. So I got myself off of that. That was a big deal that I got myself off. Do you have any crazy Ambien stories? Oh, God. It was like my kids would be here, and I'd be like, and taking out every lunch meat in the refrigerator at 4 a.m. And then I would be on airplanes and I'd watch a person on it and I'd see how they moved around like Schmeagle in Lord of the Rings, you know, and they were just like, not know that they were on it and doing, and I went, okay, that's enough of that. And you get addicted to it and then you can't sleep. So you can only take, it's so tragic what happens. That's sorry. I can't be use them as a sponsor.
No, you know, it's really, a lot of people don't understand with these drugs. It's like, and that's why I always try to warn people, because I've been on almost every antidepressant. And so I've learned which ones are, you know, really addictive and which ones are less addictive. So whenever someone is depressed and they feel like there's no other way and they have to try an antidepressant, I always suggest things that are easy to get off of, like Lexapro or Prozac. But like the one that I'm on is one of the most difficult ones to get off of. Like your brain actually goes into physical withdrawal and it's really horrible. I'm sure similar to like what you dealt with Ambien, where you were just probably up for days and feeling confused and weird. It's like the whole thing, and I don't know if you agree with me on this, is that I feel like pharmaceutical companies make these products to not make you better, but to get you hooked. To go, okay,
I don't think that's their main concern, but it is their money. It is how they make money. So, and it's funny, I was just watching a show about that. What was it? What's it called? With Kiefer Sullivan.
Kiefer something. Sutherland?
Yeah, Kiefer Sutherland had a show. I always say, I can't talk, but he had a show, Designated Survivor. It was some show from a couple of years ago. And they had a whole thing about a drug company, made a drug, got Anthony Edwards' wife hooked on it, spoiler alert. And then they came out with a new drug that counteracts what that drug did. So, I mean, what are we talking about? You know, it's
well,
like,
it's like, and I know you say, let's say they're not their MO, but like they would be out of business if they created drugs that cured people completely. Cause it'd be like, oh, you take this pill and it fixes all your problems and you never have to take it again. What does that do for them? You take it one time, they don't have you for life. With the antidepressants, they make them in a certain way so that your brain craves more of them, just like any other drug, and then you have to keep taking it and taking it and taking it. And then if you stop taking it, you're even worse than you were before because your body's gotten so used to this supplement. So it essentially is like, I mean, I just think it's really fucked up. I think it's unbelievable that in 2021, we don't have, you know, a shot that can, you know, help people that have depression in exponential ways where they don't have to take it all the time.
We're all made differently. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Because I know someone that has dissociative disorder and antidepressant, antipsychotic won't work. It really is therapy that does the job. And therapy is, if you're doing it right, is costly.
It's so costly.
But it's the necessary thing. And some people go, I'm not getting therapy. I don't believe in it. It's like, really? You don't want to explore your brain and try to help yourself? But I understand it because it is that's expensive. But
do you believe in therapy? You do therapy?
Oh, I love therapy. I mean,
therapy's great.
I had a worst first for you all teed up. This will be your soundbite.
Okay.
For the promo. The asset.
No, you're going to tell me a worst first therapist story, Dad. You're like the worst.
It's why therapist. I went to a therapist.
Okay.
First thing, it was like, I'm working with John Stamos for years and doesn't matter doing what, we always wound up doing something together. And he's like, you need to go to therapy. This is enough. I can't listen to you anymore. A podcast is really good for someone. You would talk to him about your problems? Someone, well, I just talked, and I've done it with you already. You know, a podcast is good for someone that talks about themselves a lot. But I've always worked hard. Actually, I enjoy listening more than I used to. That's why you're going to be on my podcast. So I get to have the exchange program and not only be in the, well, no, because you do what I do. You do conversations, and that's what people need. And I think they need it bad, especially mm-hmm. now they have you to listen to and help. You're helping people, you know? So mm-hmm. my worst first was when I knew I needed a therapist, I sat down at the computer. I've been working really hard. I was lucky to be. I was about to direct a movie, and I was doing a television show. This is about 10 years ago. And I had a travel agent. I have people that do stuff that help me, but I do it myself. You know, it's faster. I'll just do it myself. So I went on American Airlines, right? Sitting there. I couldn't. And I've talked to other people that have experienced this. It's when you know you got to get fixed. I couldn't fill out my name. I couldn't fill out the date. I couldn't function. It was like I had so many things I was trying to process that my brain just shorted out. And I always say I've been through a midlife crisis for 60 years, you know, and it's still continuing. But at that moment, when I'm on the site for an airline and I can't fill anything out, I literally just called this doctor that had been recommended to me by a couple of people. And I started going a couple times a week. And it took about 4 years. And I really sorted through, I think, what helped me through what is the rest of my life.
Did they diagnose you with anything or tell you like what your main issue is?
Pretty much that I'm just fucking nuts. I'm not regular. But
like, they didn't say anything in specific. They weren't like, oh, you have ADHD or you have borderline or you have nothing like that.
If I was not born when I was born, if I was born in the 20 years ago, I would have been on Ritalin, you know, because I was always running around, always hyper. You probably have similar stuff. My stuff comes out at night, you know, when other people are sleeping. Sometimes I'm doing what we shouldn't do. Go for the phone, you know, go through stuff. I mean, how many new apps are there? It's like, oh my God. I mean, I'm on TikTok looking, I'm learning, I'm watching the news, everything you shouldn't do at night. Now there's Clubhouse. You can talk to people. It's like, oh my God, why do I want to talk to more people?
I know they say, honestly, and my therapist tells me this all the time, is that because I also am a night person and I'll sleep all day and stay up all night. She always tells me, you know, before you go to bed, like an hour before you go to bed, you really need to put the phone down. She stressed that to me so many times, and I really fought her on it because I'm such a phone person, obviously social media and that kind of thing. But I did realize that for an entire week, I put a book next to my bed. My friend Kelsey wrote a book called Don't Fucking Panic. I have panic attacks. So I was reading that book and I kept it by the side of the bed. And I would read it for about an hour every night before I went to bed. And I had the best sleep of my life for that entire week. And so I try to do it as much as possible. I keep the book next to my bed. I mean, sometimes obviously we get caught up, you know, we're like, oh, I want to check this or check that. But that really helped me, was reading, because it really just winds your thoughts down. It slows you down. It slows your brain down. But I'm with you. I feel you. I mean, social media has really just, I mean, you're all the stimulation. Our brains aren't made for that. They're not made for that.
And on top of the stimulation, everybody's at each other. You know, everybody has a side to pick, and nobody's just saying, hey, come on, humanity. Yay. Yeah. You know,
yeah, I know.
You want unity? Oh, yeah. Well, now you want unity. It's like, I'm so tired of all this. It's such a bunch of shit. I know.
It's
a lot.
It's like sensory overload constantly. And our brains, as much as we'd like to think we're evolved as human beings, and yes, we are in ways, is that we still have this human brain that when you're constantly inundating the brain with new information and you know, apps and the blue light and all that stuff, that's horrible for us.
And if you really want to read on the iPad, that's not helpful either, because you got the light. You're so right.
That life's horrible for you.
Everyone I've ever known that I respect reads a book if they can't sleep before they go to bed. The worst thing you can do is turn the news on.
The worst.
Especially.
My husband does that, and he gets angry, and then he goes to bed angry. And I'm like, well, that's what you get for watching the news. Like,
yeah.
You know, so I will say that the best thing for anyone out who's listening to this is, you know, if you're really struggling or having nightmares or having trouble getting to sleep, read it. Try reading a book. Just try it, even though it sounds like the worst idea. Because we're like, oh, a book. Like, at least me, like, reading. I know, I'm not, like, a big reader, but if you can find something you're really into. You know,
you know you're a 1,000,000,000% right, because I have an aversion to books, and I love books.
Exactly.
But I couldn't, like, in school, I was given Moby Dick to read. It's like, I don't want to read about a knot for 3 pages, you know? But then... But then you give me a book that means it can even be a self-help type of book. I mean,
are great.
You can get a Deepak Chopra book, or you can get anything. I mean, you were talking about how the drug companies know that they've got a client, you know, a customer. And Brave New World, which Apple TV ran the series, which was really quite good. There were 10 of them, but it's from Huxley's book that I read, and that's what it's about. It's a really? It's a future, and they're self-contained because they can't go outside because of the air.
Wow.
And they're kept on drugs that look like little M&Ms. Do you want the blue pill, the red pill? Very Alice in Wonderland type of theory, but the idea is that they keep the whole population happy. They're always happy. And it's not human to be happy all the time. You have to feel all of it, but you can't hold on to what can. I mean, I had a friend, and it's the oldest cliche in the world, but it's called disease because it's dis-ease. And it's so obvious. Everything should be abbreviations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true.
It's because people, I know people who I knew were going to get sick. Mm-hmm. I knew they were going to get cancer. I knew they were going to get, it sounds terrible, but you hold it inside of you, or you don't let it out. Even if it's, I don't know, if it's exercise that clears your head, for me, it's always, I got to go gut deep. I've got to go where it truly feels like I've left no stone unturned. And I know my wife and I go through this where I'll just take it as deep as I can. She can resolve much quicker than I can, but then I go, well, you're not fully resolving it, but I'm wrong. I'm just being overly neurotic to make sure that I've put the issue to bed, and I've latched every latch, and I've, you know, scrubbed the floor with bleach and made sure. I'm talking metaphors, everybody. I'm not hiding a body.
I feel you.
But it's like, it's hard for the mind that, you would, if you're in panic attacks, it would mean that you have a lot of fear, right?
Yes, a lot of fear. Mm-hmm.
Is it based from, and I've listened to you and enjoyed you a lot. And
aw, thanks.
And so, is it come from childhood, do you think?
Yes, I had a very tumultuous, unpredictable childhood with my mother, who struggles with borderline personality disorder. And so I don't know if you're familiar with borderline personality
disorder. I am.
But it's basically, you kind of never know what you're going to get. You know, one day the person can be the happiest person in the world, and then the next minute they're trying to stab someone with a knife or freaking out or
whatever. It was violent.
Saying they're going to kill themselves or whatever. Yeah. And I feel so bad talking about it. No, I mean, you know, and so when you're young and you're in such a like fight or flight constantly, like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Is this person going to stab this person? Is this person going to kill themselves? Is this person going to, you know, you're constantly in the fight or flight mode. It fucks up your body in terms of development, where like my brain got kind of stuck on that fight or flight mode. And so I noticed as I got older that my anxiety, even though my parents ended up getting divorced and I ended up just being raised by my dad and with my brother, my body, just from going through that kind of trauma so young, had permanently gotten the latch stuck on the fight or flight mode. And so little things would trigger me. If you know, if someone was acting erratic or even if I got too excited, just any feelings would just cause me to go into a panic attack and I would start shaking and sweating, having trouble breathing. My heart rate would go up crazy. And yeah, I mean, I'm still working on to this day getting a handle on it, but it's not fun. Like, it's probably like the worst. I wouldn't wish a panic attack on my worst enemy, because I think a lot of people.
Wait a minute, your worst enemy?
Yeah, have you ever had a panic attack? I wouldn't.
I have had many. I mean, literally, when I was sitting at the computer trying to book a flight, I've had many panic attacks. I've even thought I was having a heart attack because it runs in my family.
And that's what you think. Did you go to the hospital?
No, because I'm smart enough to know that it was a panic attack. And
I had called
a doctor because the left side wasn't out, nothing. And, you know, I had an uncle die at 37 on a tennis court, 39 running after kids that stole his tire. So he was angry, yelling. Another one is 41. He was smoking 6 packs of cigarettes a day, and his wife and he would fight. So they never stopped fighting, and he died on the couch. And my dad had 2 heart attacks when he was 40 and 41. And so I thought, okay, heart attack's going to take me out. So it was always in the back
symptoms?
Of my mind.
Not to interrupt you. What were your symptoms? Sorry, I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's different for everyone.
It was that heart palpitating thing where you can't look at anything from the outside. Everything, you're trapped, and you are positive everything is just over. It feels
like the end of your life for sure, right?
Yes, and many people are living that right now. You know that because
I had one 3 nights ago, but I've been doing EMDR therapy, which is supposed to be the most productive. Have you heard of that?
Tell me about it. I have heard about it, but
it's supposed to be the most productive for people that have unresolved trauma, and so basically, I felt like to me in my brain, I go, "Oh, it happened so long ago. I don't have any unresolved trauma. Like, I don't care. I think about." The stuff with my mom and her and I have a okay relationship now. And so I'm like, okay, I don't hold on to things. I'm not, but as you know, the body keeps the score. That's a book.
Yep.
You know, and your body remembers whether you want to remember or not.
With sense memory.
Your body goes, no. We don't let it go. So you have to really do the deep therapy. And so what EMDR does is.
What does it stand for?
You know, I was just going to. Say, electromagnetic. I always forget. It's like electromagnetic. Hang on, I'll look it up right now. But yeah, basically, what you do is they
Jewish lasers?
That's hilarious. That lady. Okay, it stands for. I'm sorry. You know what? It's not electromagnetic. It's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Whoa.
Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So this is what they do, and. Listen, I've been doing it for about 6 weeks now. And at first I thought, oh God, this is so stupid. This is not going to do anything. But for the first time a few nights ago, I had another really bad, I wake up out of my sleep with panic attacks because they can't really get me during the day because I know what they are and I feel them coming on and then I can take like my CBD or something to calm down. They only get me in my sleep now. So
is it a nightmare?
I won't even necessarily be having a nightmare. My body will just take advantage of the fact that I'm, you know.
Do you have someone outside? Is that your?
My husband keeps opening and closing the doors in the house, and they all have alarms, and I'm going to kill him in 2 seconds.
You should probably just turn off the yapping person.
I know. I don't even know how to do it. It's so, I'm just going to text him to stop opening the doors.
I think it's *7.
Sorry. but yeah, no, basically, now they only get me in my sleep. And so the EMDR, what they do is I do it remotely because of obviously COVID, but they bring you to some of the darkest points in your life. They ask you how bothersome they are to you on a scale of 1 to 10. And then they break it down till it's nothing. They take it like to each moment, to each thought, to each sensitivity of that event that happened to you, and they break it down and they help you to reprocess it and to think like, oh, take yourself back there, comfort yourself, remind yourself that you're safe now and that kind of thing. And then you follow this little ball, or at least I do. I follow this little ball on a screen with my eyes, and it kind of like not hypnotizes you, but it helps you reprogram. That's what it is. It's like a weird, but I've noticed, like I said, I at first I was like, oh, this is bullshit in my head, you know? But then now I'm like, I had a horrible call 911 panic attack the other night, and I didn't call 911. My heart rate will go up to like 160, and my blood pressure will go up to like.
Do you have a blood pressure thing in your house so you know where it was?
Because I have to check. I check myself because sometimes it gets so high that it is in heart attack zone, and then I have to take a beta blocker. So. And that's all just trauma. It has nothing to do with my health. I've had my heart checked, you know, every which way, but it's the trauma and the adrenaline flooding your system, getting ready to have you run from a lion, but I was fast asleep. So it's just horrible. It's like my wires are all crossed. And so I have the blood pressure cuff. So I'll like check. My blood pressure was like 143 over 95. My heart rate was 160. And normally I would have called an ambulance because that's so high, you know. It says on my little thing, hypertensive crisis, you know, which is technically a heart attack. And so then now I just stopped and I thought, and I was like, you know what? Take your beta blocker, give it a minute. If your heart rate still doesn't go down, then call 911. But
what's a beta blocker? What's it made of?
A beta blocker is something that it has a chemical in it that slows the heart rate. So they give
it's them not people, like a melatonin, is it?
No. Beta blockers are usually for given to people that. Sometimes they give them to comedians because they get nervous to perform. It basically blocks your heart rate from going higher than like 90. You know,
is it like an herbal Xanax? Is that
what
it is?
No, it's not herbal. It's a prescription.
Oh, it's a drug. So it's like a Xanax Ativan type thing?
It's not like an Ativan or Xanax in terms of like it doesn't calm you down. Like it doesn't make you sedated. It just makes your heart rate. It opens your blood vessels in your heart so that your heart can get more thorough oxygen. And so your heartbeat gets slower. So it's good for
that would,
panic
I'd probably
attacks.
Have a heart attack on that because I would try to break through it.
Yeah. It's a little weird when you're so whenever this happens to me, I usually have to take something to calm my nerves and then also the beta blocker because it's weird when you're having a panic attack and then your heart's going boom, boom. Boom, and it's going slow, and then you're like, okay, is it going to stop? Am I dying? So it's like too fast or too slow. I can't win. But
I wish that for you that you could have some calm because you deserve it.
Yeah, well, I'm working on it. I definitely have like really good. I've had like a lot of good days lately. Knock on wood. I'm knocking on wood because I'm so superstitious. But yeah, I have a lot of good days lately. But I'm really, like, I have to say, I'm really impressed by people like you who have, you know, demons and have struggled, but have, you fought through it and.
I fight through it all the time, though.
You do
like,
therapy.
The reason I know I'm, I love what I do is that I, for the most part, my wife might disagree, but I, for the most part, I wake up wanting to do something good, you know?
Good.
It's like, unless, and I wake up thinking it's, you know, okay, I'm ready to go. And then you turn on the news and then it's like a big barrel of shit just dumped on your head as soon as you, it's like stepping out on the front porch, you know, oh, take the day in and just.
And then someone just throws a bag of shit at you. You're like, hey.
It's always go, shit.
And some of the shit gets in your mouth. You're like,
right.
Yeah, that's horrible. It's,
And then, you hear the hatred that's out there and all of the lies that you hear that you go, well, no, people can't believe that. That what?
Yeah.
And that drives me crazy. But I just want peace of mind is like, that's the gift.
Right.
And your health, good health
yes.
and peace of mind and have love in your life. Even through this. And I know that a lot of people can't have it right now. And there are a lot of single people. Maybe they don't even have family much to speak of. So they're alone. So that's why, you know, they'll turn to you. They'll listen to you.
Yeah.
You know?
They love to have the podcast or something to listen to is really helpful to a lot of people, you know?
Yeah. I have another worst first for you that'll be lighter.
I was just about to ask.
I have a good one, like first rock and roll gig. Those are always fun.
Oh, no way. Okay, wait, we're going to take a quick break, guys, with Bob Saget, and we'll be right back on Worst Firsts. Okay, we're back. Bob's got another worst for us. Bob, I love that you came prepared with worst because I get so many people on the podcast, and like I love just talking to people about life, but you know, the whole premise is some of the worst stuff you've ever been through. So I love that you came with
Well, as soon as I knew that that was the premise, I mean, my God, my brain just had, I had 10 things come to the forefront.
Your brain was like, pick me, pick me, pick me, pick me.
I'm like those little things in Despicable Me. They all want to be taken under the chute.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's one. So I had been signed by rock promoters as a client when I was on a Comedy Store college tour when I was 22. Mm-hmm. And they were, he's since passed, but Brad Gray, who was my manager for many years and then ended up running Paramount. And then we lost him a few years ago. And he worked for Harvey Weinstein, who was a rock promoter. So they were my managers when I was 22 years old. Wow. Imagine that. And
do you have any stories about him?
Yeah. Say again?
I said, do you have any stories about Harvey?
He never mounted me. He never walked in on me in the bath. I had my appendix out in LA and I almost died and he came to visit me. He was actually, but at that time he was like 28 years old, you know, it was a different guy, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe not. I thought so though. I mean, I think yeah. he was, the success hadn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. So I was opening for people and I opened for a bunch of different people, but they got me a gig opening at Maple Leaf Gardens. But the big one before that was Buffalo Memorial Auditorium. And I opened for Gino Vannelli. I don't know if you know who that is, but he sang, I just want to stop and tell you what I feel about you, babe. See that song, how it lasted. So that was his hit. And very nice guy. So I opened for him a couple times. And then they said, oh, Bob did great. That's 20,000 people. You know, I'm 23 years old, whatever.
And you were playing guitar and singing?
Yeah.
Wow.
But that wasn't my song. That was Gino Vannelli's song. But I would do comedy parodies and comedy songs, and I would do stand-up. But I had the guitar on a lot, and then I took it off to learn how to do my craft that I, because you can't hide behind, you can't be a prop comic forever. But now, every special I do, I've got three or four original comedy songs in it. So, but the nightmare gig was I was at Maple Leaf Gardens and I was opening for Max Webster. Your husband would know this, maybe, but he would know that they were a counterpart. They broke off from the group Rush. And Rush.
Oh, I know Rush. Yeah. Rush.
So what was left of Rush became Max Webster. And in Canada, they were huge. So they sold out the Maple Leaf Gardens and it's, I don't know what it was, 16,000, 20,000 people. And I'm on stage opening for Max Webster. And ladies and gentlemen, here he is, Bob Saget. I'm 23 years old. I've got a guitar on. And, I think I was wearing Wallabies. I'm not sure. It was pretty sad. And crappy shoes. And so I walk out on stage and I start saying something and there's like no response. And I'd played behind chicken wire already. My career was already, you know, doing the road, learning the how bad it is. Everybody always has their worst road stories. Yeah. And they were going, Max, 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 Max. And they were lighting matches. And then I started doing the normal thing. You want to see Max? That doesn't help me.
Right.
And going, yeah. And then I think I said, fuck. And that got them to applaud. And then I did a couple of parodies like Elton John. I think I was maybe the first guy to do the most obvious, horrific parody of an Elton John song. It was Don't Let Your Son Go Down on Me. So,
oh my God.
It was just horrific.
And they didn't like you? They booed
you? Well, no, I did 3 minutes. Oh, my God. And the promoter was Michael Cole. And Michael ended up, I'm sure Tommy Lee knows Michael Cole. He started Live Nation and Ticketmaster. No conflict of interest there. And then I really loved him. He was a friend for a while. And I still know him. But he... he's on the side of the stage and it was like slow motion. I said, can I leave now? And he waves me like I can leave. And I went over the mic. Will I still get paid? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, thank you, everybody. Enjoy Max. And they paid me, but it was disaster.
It was absolutely so sad.
The worst thing. I haven't had that. I mean, playing behind chicken wire, but gig wise, I was watching Bill Maher the other night and somebody asked him, Oh, he was on, what was he on? He was on something good. I can't remember, but he was asked, do you ever worry about bombing? And do you ever bomb? Someone asked, do you ever bomb? And he said, I've been doing this 40 years. No, I don't bomb. And so I'm kind of the same way. I mean, I've been doing it 40 years. I've been doing more than that. You know, so it's not a variable. It can't happen. It might not be the best. It might not be my A game. I'm trying to do my A game and I'm trying to adapt, especially now when I get to go out. I think I go back on tour as a stand up near the end of the year is the plan. Mm-hmm. And then I will do wherever I am. I'm just trying to put people together, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get on stage and talk about unity unless it's, you know, sarcastic so they can cheer it. I'm trying to please all sides and all people. I don't like that there's sides, but that's where we're at.
Do you enjoy stand up? Like when you go, or you this is what you live for?
It's one of the things I have to do.
You have to do. I hear that from a lot of comedians that they are like, I don't have a choice. Like this
Well, it's like music. I mean, it you have to do it. If you can retire, but you don't end up retiring. No. Like stand up. I mean, Steve Martin retired, but not, he really didn't. I mean,
right.
He and Marty Short went out and did this amazing show. And Steve first went out to get the audience vibe with his band, his bluegrass band. And, you know, and he's an exception. He's one of the best that's ever been in anything. He's brilliant and beautiful. But, and, you know, I know that within that show with the band, it was 12 minutes, a new stand up because he's Steve Martin. So I just look to what makes me as funny as I can be. And I feel like I was talking to Bill Burr and I said, I haven't even done what I came here to do yet. And he said, well, you better fucking hurry up.
I love him. He doesn't give a fuck. He's like, well, you better fucking.
It's so funny because people accuse him of stuff and he's exactly.
He doesn't care.
He doesn't care, but he's also one of the best people alive.
He gives zero fucks. He's hilarious. That's so cool to hear. So has it been hard? Because obviously you haven't been able to be on the road and you haven't been able to.
It has been. I'm about to right now when this is coming out right now, I am in the Cayman Islands. At this moment, I'm not, but you know, I'm meeting in a couple days for the Cayman Islands to shoot a movie. So I'm going to be acting in a film under very careful. I go into quarantine for 2 weeks. If you break quarantine, you go to jail for 3 months in the Cayman Islands. So you know what happens there. I don't feel like having that done.
Scary.
Yeah, it's dramatic.
My Lord, jail in the Cayman Islands jail.
Yeah, it's going to be nice.
Oh my God! Right? It's just like. The bars are made out of coconuts. You're like, this isn't that.
And a poo-poo platter is that's your butt.
That's so exciting, though, that you're going to shoot a movie. That's fun. And it's
good to get out of the United States. It's an acting part, so I'll be acting. And and then I'm just finishing a second draft on a script that I can't talk about, but you'll be happy about it.
Good.
It's one of those cool things with a great comedians kind of thing. So and the podcast, I love doing my podcast.
Tell us again on here the name of your podcast so that people can go follow you. And I'm going to be on Bob's podcast right after this, you guys. So make sure to go check that out. It's called
It's called Bob Saget's Here For You. Here For You is an actual.
I said Bob Saget's Inside of You.
Well, that's fine. There is one called Inside of You because today, Michael Rosenbaum, now I'm telling you when we're recording this, Michael Rosenbaum is called Inside of You.
That's where I saw you. I saw you on there and then I just.
Exactly.
So Bob Saget is here for you. I love that.
Bob Saget is here for you and he wants to be inside of you. But you can't say that because you'll get canceled. But I didn't say that.
You didn't say that.
We'll no, I didn't say anything. I'm a politician. I never said anything. So, so it's Bob Saget's Here For You. There is a Here For You podcast that I didn't know existed, or I would have jerry-rigged another name. But it's something I love because I have a lot of people on that I love and some that I just am interested in and new friends like you. That's why we're baseball card trading our podcast, which is
fun. That's why you do what you do on here. So guys, make sure to go check out Bob's podcast. Make sure to follow Bob on Instagram, just at Bob Saget on Instagram, right? You're just,
yeah,
Bob.
That's and what I Twitter thought, yeah. And BobSaget.com. I'll tell you my everything. Dates. And
yes, I'm so excited and I've loved having you here. This was thank such a treat. And thank you for coming so prepared with your worsts. You were always, one of the most prepared guests.
I wish I could do innuendo still, because I was going to say I always come prepared. But you can't say that, because then people go, oh, you're filthy. You eat babies in a pizza place. You know, I'm not. I'm just,
you
I
still
like,
have that, like, you're still, because you're like, it's like when in the 90s you could say like whatever you wanted, and now you can't say anything. So you have to be.
Yeah. I do, though. I okay. still do. And I was doing some stand-up. I did a couple things. I went to do Dave Chappelle's comedy camp. And I was there with, and Louis C.K. was there, and Chris Spencer and Chris Tucker and Darnell and Michelle Wolf. And I just loved every second of it. But we had to close down because there was one person that had some COVID. And so,
oh, I heard about that, actually. I heard about that.
And so we had to shut. So it was the last show I was there.
That was in Texas, right?
No, that was in Ohio. Oh,
Ohio, okay.
Yeah, the one in Texas is Dave was had COVID and now he's well. He's just working with Joe Rogan in Austin again, and they're doing their thing. And Dave is another incredibly special, amazing person. So I got to do that, and it felt like heaven. I am a stand up, but I also love making movies and stuff. So I don't know. I try to do a 1,000% whatever I'm doing.
I'm glad you get to do what you love to do. That's not many people can say that. So you're very blessed.
Thank you.
And you're a national treasure.
I am. Nicolas Cage is looking for me.
Dead. All right, guys. It's been lovely having you. I'm so excited. And I can't wait to do your podcast. We're about to do it right now. So guys, make sure to check me out on Bob's podcast and make sure to subscribe and like, and make sure to leave a comment and tell us how much you love us, because we need that validation in our lives. That's why we do this.
And we'll subscribe and follow, or subscribe and listen and follow.
Yes, yes, yes. We'll see you all next week on another episode of Worst.